Today is Monday, July 20th, and this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We take you behind the news and into local culture to help us better understand this beautiful and complex Central Coast that we all share. I'm Monica Lopez. It's summertime, and we're bringing you two of our favorite Issues and Ideas segments from 2026, as well as something new. We revisit two interviews, one from Bookwave's producer Brian Reynolds with award-winning author Susan Strait. Strait talks about her latest book, Sacrament.
I think that people are afraid to read about COVID because it brings back such terrible memories, but I felt COVID so intensely because so many of my friends are nurses.
And Raise Up Radio producer Julie Lynam spotlights the struggles of marginalized communities to explore real-world solutions, especially for youth and their families.
Human brains are wired to see difference. Like, we notice differences. It's part of how we navigate the world. It's not the noticing of difference that's the issue. It's the values that we place on the differences we notice.
But first, we hear about one of the last standing juke joints in the country. Teddy's Juke Joint sits just east of the Mississippi River, a 20-minute drive from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. In its heyday, the venue was both an incubator and a hub for some of the greatest blues talent in the United States. Historically, juke joints were safe havens from the violence and systemic cruelty of the Jim Crow South, where Black Americans could relax and have a good time. As Issues and Ideas contributor Tom Wilmer reports, Teddy's Juke Joint was built to celebrate and historically preserve those Jim Crow era sanctuaries.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Louisiana in East Baton Rouge Parish. We're in the outback right now near the village of Zachary. We've just bounced along on a gravel road through the pitch black night to visit with Lloyd Johnson Jr., known fondly throughout the South as Teddy, the 74-year-old owner of Teddy's Juke Joint for the past four decades. Juke joints are typically simply decorated front rooms of an old sharecropper's shack where friends congregate to sing the blues, dance the night away, and down a pint or two. These havens for sharecroppers at one time dotted the rural countryside throughout the Deep South, but there are just a handful still operating today. A new Baton Rouge acquaintance, April Sexy Red Jackson, says,
to understand what a juke joint is, to walk in a facility or a place that's raggedy, the lights, mostly Christmas lights, usually they're either white or red, hanging all types of ways, stuff all over the place. It looks like it hadn't had a good dusting in years. That's a juke joint to me. People laughing and talking, and as soon as you open the door, everybody turns around, hey! And then you say, hey, you know, that's a juke joint. A lot of blues. They're off the dirt roads. Teddy's Juke Joint, you go out there in Zachary at night and you can't see anything, but he has this little tiny light that's flashing. But the juke joint is all the way off the road, way in the back, which gives you that good feel of that country down home connection in a juke joint.
Lloyd Johnson says one reason for the demise of the juke joint is that young people balk at paying a cover charge just to cover the cost of the band. Today, he's happy if he makes enough from beer sales to pay the utilities.
What brought you up this week?
You.
Oh, okay. My last name is Johnson. My real name is Lloyd Johnson Jr., and I'm the owner and creator of Teddy's Juke Joint.
So where'd the name Teddy come in?
Well, it was given to me when I was born.
Because you look like a teddy bear?
I have no idea. I didn't know Teddy wasn't my real name until I went to first grade in 1953.
So how did you decide to open a juke joint?
Well, different people was telling me I need to open my own juke joint. I started out spinning records. And it just evolved, and one time I got tired of spinning records. I said, well, I just go on to my own place or something. I wouldn't have to do all that traveling. They call it being a DJ today.
On the radio.
Yeah, but I quit radio in 1965 because I made more money spinning records, but I traveled 100,000 miles a year.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So who typically comes to Teddy's Juke Joint?
Well, let's put it like this. Every Saturday night, Jesus stopped by and get him a glass of wine. But people comes to my place from 50 countries.
Really?
And all over the United States.
But I bet you also have a lot of local neighborhood people out in the country.
Well, yeah, but they don't frequent the place as much as my tourists do.
So you become a legend.
Well, that's what everybody tells me. It's like week before last, I had some people from Sweden, Mexico last week, Denmark earlier this year, and Canadians for the last 15, 20 years, they in here every month.
So when you were growing up, when did you first become aware of juke joints, and did you like hanging out and going to juke joints?
Well, I was born in the juke joint era, and my aunt had a little place that she called the Cedar Tree, and she didn't sell nothing but beer and fish sandwiches and chicken and stuff like that, and she ran that until she got too old to run it. And but I've been around juke joints all my life. It started back in slavery. And during the time the slaves wanted to get a dollar for a bale of hay, 100 pounds of hay, whatever it was, and they wanted a day off. So what happened is the different plantation owners, they wanted to stop them from singing in the fields. And so when they gave them the day off, where they could have little places like this, and that's how the juke joint began. But the slave owners found out they couldn't get no work done because didn't nobody understand what each other was saying. And now I am one of the last 5 juke joints in America. And especially on Highway 61. From Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico.
Which is the blues highway, right?
Right.
Back when you were growing up, some locals were telling me that back in the day that juke joints, the owner and the family typically lived behind or adjacent to the juke joint. Is that your, was
well,
that like
yes.
the case with your aunt?
Yeah, yeah, most of them lived in them. Like I was born in this one in 1946. And it's the owner's address I ever had in my whole life. And it's gonna be the owner's address I'm gonna have until the day I die.
So when you get groups to play here, where do they typically come from? Like where are these guys from?
The fellas that's playing tonight, they're from the Baton Rouge area. One of the fellas in there, his name is Sam Hogan. He's 65 years old, and he's been playing since he was 8 years old. And I get a few locals, but I get a lot of people, a lot of bands out of Mississippi and New Orleans, First California, Washington, all over. But basically, Mississippi, Alabama.
Do they have like a circuit? Do they play different juke joints? Or?
Well, they used to have the chilling circuit that you don't have anymore. And it was started in Louisiana. B.B. King played the chillin' circuit.
Didn't the chillin' circuit go all the way up to Arkansas?
Well, the chillin' circuit, it started in Louisiana and it went on up through Arkansas, Mississippi, all the way up to Chicago.
Because I was in a small nowhere town in Arkansas, and there was a sign where there was a juke joint where B.B. King used to play, one that burned down.
B.B. King ate crumbs off my grandmother's table. I've been knowing B.B. King ever since I've been big enough to know anybody.
Tell me about that, what you remember about him.
Well, I remember he would come by, my grandmother, whatever she had left over, she would feed him. And he would sleep on the front porch or out in her barn or whatever, or in his car, and went on where he had to go. So 2017, for B.B. King's day, my topic was the chilling circuit, and they made Highway 82, the B.B. King's Highway. That's in Indiola, Mississippi. I've known B.B. King, like I said, my whole life, just about as long as I knew, big enough to remember people.
Did he ever play at your family's juke joint?
No, he would play a little bit on my grandmother's front porch.
Uh-huh. And you were right there to listen?
Right. And things like that. And a lot of times, see, they did a lot of yard parties, or you might call it, you used to call them suppers back in the day. And they would just play because the people would let them stay all night because they had to have somewhere to stay because they couldn't stay in hotels and motels.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Tom Wilmer is speaking with Lloyd Teddy Johnson, owner of one of the last standing juke joints in the country. And now back to Issues and Ideas.
Well, you know, one of the most interesting thing about me making a juke joint out of this place is that my grandmother told me a long time ago when she was still living, and she stepped off a piece of land for my mom to build her house. And so my mom did. She said, son, when you get a wife or get to be a man, I'm gonna step off you a piece of property too. And I said, okay, Grandma. But you know, I wasn't understanding what she was saying. And she also told me, she said, as long as you live, or as long as any of my grandchildren, or my children live, great-grandchildren, they always have a place to stay. So here I'm here still at Teddy's Juke Joint, 41 years. Born in the building in 1946. And the good Lord done blessed me at 2019 to be 73 years old and still in the same spot that I was born in. So 41 years ago, I opened up this place.
Do you have any kids or any descendants, grandkids?
Yes, I have 6 boys. One is dead. And I don't wish this place on neither one of them. Because it's not what people think it is. It's a juke joint, but as far as a man or a woman making a living, it's just not there.
So do you think the era of juke joints is over?
Well, I don't think...
You think it's a dying...
Well, it is a dying industry in America.
Right.
But other countries is keeping it alive. And it all goes back to our ancestors, which were slaves. And, you know, I think it's real serious about... Our president wants to put up a wall when all over the world, America been helping people to tear down walls. You wonder why all the people from other countries, 50 countries I know for a fact, comes to America just to research the blues. The blues man have traveled more areas than all the presidents in America. The blues is the international language of the world. Everybody understands the blues.
Ooh, honey, climb up to Blackbird. You know my woman done quit me. Ooh, man, look at the whole round world again.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Tom Wilmer is speaking with Lloyd Teddy Johnson, owner of one of the last standing juke joints in the country. And now back to Issues and Ideas.
Ooh, I said she wouldn't send me no kind of wine.
Blues is, it's life itself. From the day you're born to the day you die. That's the life of a blues man. When you got the blues, you don't outlive it. It outlives you. It brings you in the world and it takes you out. You know, some people live a lifetime and they never find themselves or nothing that they want to do. The good Lord must have meant for me to do it, you know, because as for now, I don't see no turning around. It's just one of these things that you have to take it day by day. And that's what the blues is all about. It's a day by day thing. You know, you don't really know exactly what tomorrow will bring. And where some professions, you know what your monthly income will be, what your yearly salary will be, and how much you're gonna make when you retire.
So You don't know that.
Not, you don't know none of that with the blues. You might make $100 today, and it might cost you $500 tomorrow to leave this same place. Well, a lot of other musicians that don't do the blues, they got their plane ticket for the next 6 months already paid for. Their problem is just making the gig. And these are the things that the blues man had to cope with each and every day. Just like the band in that plane now. I'm hoping like hell I'll make enough money to pay them tonight because I'm not charging a cover charge on the dope. Usually the cover charge give you a little incentive to what you might have, and I don't have to put up as much.
Mm-hmm. But the cover charge just doesn't work.
No, it don't work because people agree not to play it. They'd rather go to a festival or a big river center, a Superdome or something, and pay $75 to $100 for a seat. And they got to look at the big screen to see the performer that's performing. Well, you can come to Teddy's Juke Joint, and you sit close enough to the person to touch them. And you know that's a real person there. But the cultural things that I found out about life, most people just take it for granted that it's there and it's supposed to be.
But what you're saying, it might not be.
Well, if you think about it, how many universities that you ever heard of where a blues man can go and get a degree in the blues? You name anything else beside the blues, you can get a degree in. Or call it a trade. They don't even call the blues a trade. And that was just one of the things and stuff like that happened. All right, and thank you for taking the time out to come and interview me.
My pleasure and my
honor.
Next
time you want to come, give me a call and we'll set up a time where we can sit down and talk and kick it around a while.
I love it. I look forward to it. Okay.
All right, thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
That was KCBX's Tom Wilmer speaking with Lloyd Teddy Johnson, owner of Teddy's Juke Joint near Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We'll be right back. Next up, Book Waves, where producer Brian Reynolds speaks with authors about the craft of storytelling and their latest works. In this segment, Brian speaks with Susan Strait, author and distinguished professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. Her book, Sacrament, was selected as the 2026 Annual Book of the Year by Cuesta College and Slo County Public Library. The book focuses on the lives of ICU nurses during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much for having me. You know I love the radio.
We do. Radio is so exciting, just like a good book. Your book was honored as the 2026 Book of the Year, sponsored by the County of San Luis Obispo Public Libraries, Cuesta College, and the Paso Robles City Library. Quite an honor. How did you feel about that?
Oh, my goodness. I'm so excited. I've spoken at Cuesta College way back in the day. It's a big deal, especially because I'm very much a pure California writer. And so I love San Luis Obispo. Cuesta College is one of my favorite places I've ever been.
Could you tell our audience just a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this particular book?
I'm a native of Riverside. I was born in the hospital that's 3 blocks from my house. And it's a hospital that's much like the setting for the new book. This is my 10th novel. I still live in Riverside. My mom is 91. She immigrated from Switzerland and she has dementia and she learned to speak English from listening to Vin Scully do Dodger broadcasts.
Wow.
So I tell you that because I think that's when I first became obsessed with language, was listening to my little mom navigate not just English, but American English and then very much Southern California English. So yeah, I went to public school. I got a full scholarship to USC, and I was a sports writer, but I always wanted to write fiction. And this particular book, Sacrament, it is one of the hardest things and the most loving things I think I've ever written. It takes place during COVID, which was a difficult decision, but I've been traveling all over the country for the last 6 months, and I have hundreds of nurses and medical professionals and doctors and teachers come and tell me how much the book meant to them.
I noticed in your email that you have UCR, University of California, Riverside there. Are you a lecturer or a professor there?
I'm a distinguished professor at UCR. I started when I was 27, and I was just getting ready to publish my first novel, Aqua Boogie. And so I've been teaching there ever since. 30 of my former students have gone on to publish novels or collections of poetry, and almost all of them are native Californians, and that makes me really happy. So yes, I'm distinguished professor of creative writing. I love teaching as well.
Just as a sidebar, I was a psychology major and at Berkeley, and really enjoyed cognitive psych, which is how we process stimuli and make decisions in our priorities. And there are two art forms above all else that stimulate what's called the imagining nerve. Albert Einstein, if you recall, says imagination is more important than intellect. And that happens to be radio and books.
Exactly. My two favorite things in the world. I mean, I do love to dance too, I'm not going to lie. But yes, for me, music, because my mom grew up in Switzerland and she was so poor, she never had the idea that music could exist. And so there were five of us kids. And it wasn't until I went to elementary school and was hanging around with my friends and heard their parents play old school blues, even Mexican corridos, that I became obsessed with the radio. So you're going to laugh about this, but remember Casey Kasem's American Top 40?
Sure.
Every time I hang out with my friends, we talk about how lovely the music world was back then. You could hear Aretha Franklin, Led Zeppelin, and Santana, like all in the same 10 minutes. So yes, I think music and books allow us to project our own imaginations, and we create our own scenarios, and that keeps the brain active.
Give a shout out to Art Laveau also.
Oh my goodness, Art Laveau. I wrote a piece about Art Laveau's birthday concert, and that was last summer. It was in the LA Times, and listeners are welcome to look it up. It's easy to find, but the new DJ, Angel Baby Rodriguez, who fills in every night for Art Laveau, drives from Riverside to Palm Springs, and that's where they do the live show. So that's what I go to sleep listening to every night. My girls know that I'm going to be listening to the old school Art Laveau, and that plays a big part in the book, because when I came up with the idea for Sacrament, I had this character in mind for my last book, Mecca, named Lorette Embers. And she is one of those people who was an amazing singer in high school. And now she's a nurse and she still sings in community theater. But during COVID, there is no community theater. And she sings one night to a patient and everyone starts to hear that she would sing to your family member who's in a coma. And so music was a huge part of this. And there is even a lowrider funeral in this book, and Art Laveau is referenced numerous times. So
wow.
Yeah, I owe most of this book to my dedication to listening to the radio, which helped me write even when things were said in the book.
You know, we're going to take a dive into the book here in a little bit and have a reading, but how and why did you choose the theme, a particular theme of ICU nurses during the early days of COVID? What was the trigger for that?
Well, that was a difficult one because I think that people are afraid to read about COVID because it brings back such terrible memories. But I felt COVID so intensely because so many of my friends are nurses. And then in my neighborhood, we had traveling nurses during COVID. A pair of nurses that lives on my block rented out rooms in their house to Carrie, who was from Texas, and Pam, who was from Indiana. And they would walk by my house every single night on their way to their shift at Riverside Community Hospital. And they would tell me stories about their patients and about how much they missed home. And to me, that heart of the novel was the traveling nurses that came and dedicated their lives to saving the lives really of strangers while their own families were far away. And then, as I said, I think when I was looking at how to assess what we went through in COVID, I mean, we still read novels about the Dust Bowl, don't we? And we'll still read novels about World War II. Those are some of the best-selling novels even now. And I think that I wanted to write about this while it was still fresh in my mind. I lost my neighbor to COVID. He died in his house. Jim Calderon, and that was a big deal. He was a big man, a groundskeeper for Pomona College, and he died in his house. He'd already had two legs amputated, and you just don't forget seeing your friend and neighbor taken out of his house. And so my neighbor across the street, Johnny Orta, lost his uncle Frank. My next door neighbor, Mario Soria, was in the first 100 people to get COVID in California. He almost died. These were all big, hardworking guys. Frank Orta, who died, was a Riverside Police Department motorcycle officer who was kind of the inspiration for the character Johnny Frias, who is in Mecca and in Sacramento. I think to not write about COVID means that it recedes into the distance. But the loss is just like 9/11, don't you think so? We were afraid to read about 9/11, and that was a huge loss. And so I feel like as a novelist, maybe I want people to be able to remember those times, but also remember with the nurses, this sort of love and intimacy and care that was given.
Yeah, it's the overall mood of the book is a mix, of course, of joy and grief, funny things and tragedy. It was very moving. I was, as I said in an email to you, I was on the verge of tears numerous times. What were some of the misconceptions that people had about the book going into it, or in presentations you've given, that you want to clarify either out of your own head or through the book?
I haven't had that happen at all. I was in Florida, I was in New York, I was in Texas, in the Bay Area, and really most people want to talk about their experiences if they didn't have COVID, trying to understand what it felt like. And so for them, the way the nurses were describing, for example, like all these large men who really were hit hard by COVID, they had to be put on their stomachs in order to breathe well. And that's such an uncomfortable position, especially for a big, strong man, isn't it? To be lying on your stomach. And I'll never forget my friend, Marcia Bales, who we've been going to church together for 35 years. She would walk by and tell me how bad it made her feel that they were so defenseless when they were lying on their stomachs, that they were uncomfortable because they felt defenseless. So everyone at almost all these events, large or small, has said that they felt as if they learned what it would be like to have COVID if they didn't have it. And those people who were healthcare workers especially appreciated it, because no matter what, even if you were a respiratory therapist or even if you were in maintenance at the hospital, you got COVID. I don't think I've had any misconceptions about it. The interesting part is the date gardens part, the section where Raquel, who is the daughter of Charisse, one of the other main characters, Raquel is 15. And so her mom sends her away to Mecca, the date gardens of Mecca, which is in Coachella Valley, to live with her great aunt. And that is something that happened to a lot of my friends who are medical professionals. They sent their kids to go live with someone else because they were so scared of them getting COVID. Raquel is working in the date gardens. And I did an event in La Quinta and one in Palm Springs. And all these people who worked in date gardens showed up. And they were like, how did you know the exact dates and how to harvest them? And I will tell you, it's because I have gone to do journalism in the Coachella Valley for 25 years. And I got to know all these people that work at date gardens. So I know how you pollinate the dates and how the date blossoms are. That was one of my favorite things to write about, is that people didn't realize 99% of all dates that are sent around the world, like even for Muslim holy days, they all come from Coachella.
That's so fascinating. I'd like to remind everybody, I am Brian Reynolds for Book Waves on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we're joined by author Susan Strait to discuss her award-winning book, Sacrament. Would you like to do a reading, Susan?
I'd love to. I'm going to read you this little part that I was just mentioning about Coachella. And this character, Raquel, like many high school students, is very angry to have to do everything on Zoom. But Raquel has been sent away from San Bernardino to Oasis, and she's living with her great aunt, who is in her 80s. Raquel took her flashlight and sat with her legs over the edge of the top bunk bed. She shined the light on the floor, on the walls, and around the windowsill. She looked out the top pane above the swamp cooler at the rows of date palm trees that came all the way up to the edge of the yard. It was still so hot that the starlight made the fronds and the trunks silver, and that looked cool, even if it wasn't. The ceiling fan was clacking 5 feet away from her house, the window cooler roaring in the only bedroom at Lolo's old adobe house. It was 109 degrees in Oasis today. 42 days she'd been out here, away from her mother, from San Bernardino, from decent internet so she could do her summer school assignments for the STEM Academy. Now she had virtual school all year, and that meant she had to set up her Chromebook in the packing house, the only place with Wi-Fi. She was in a storage room with a bare light bulb over her for Zoom. But the main thing, the scary thing, is she was freaked out about the mother scorpions waiting for their babies to be born. And she couldn't believe her mother had forgotten the story about the adobe bricks, how Lolo and her husband had made them by hand, and how they had little air bubbles where baby scorpions hide and then crawl down the walls.
That is so creepy. But
it's a true story. It's a true story.
I believe it. And then Raquel as a character was so so brave, for lack of a better word. You know, there's so many overarching themes in the book, such as the courage of nurses, the courage of people, the loving relationships, the importance of racial diversity. What would you say are the top two or three important topics that you want the public to get from your novel that stand out above all others?
Oh, that's a good question. Because I love that I've gone to talk to high school and college students, and they love to read about Raquel and how lonely she was during COVID. And I know my own students have felt that way, even though that was 6 years ago. You know, it was 6 years ago, pretty much a few weeks ago. The loneliness that especially young people felt during COVID is something that I hope that people take away. And Raquel, she's terrified for her mother, so she ends up running away, and then she puts herself in more danger. So I think I really wanted to write about how it was for students who felt lonely and teenagers who had to live their lives on Zoom. And then the other thing is back to the idea of grief. I think for COVID, one thing that people have told me all around the country is people forget your loved one died alone in the hospital. And the only one there with them would be a nurse or a doctor. So Lorette is singing to patients when they're in a coma. And I've had many friends and family members tell me that they felt as if they had dreams during a coma that they never forgot, even when they woke up. And Lorette is the person that's sort of there calming them and comforting them. But the family members are on FaceTime. And people might not know this about COVID. Your nurse was your conduit to your family member. Like, that's the only way you could talk to your family member. So I wanted people to think about what a position nurses had. I mean, nurses have been essential throughout history, but during COVID especially, they were the ones that called you about family members, showed you your family member. And so the singing and Lorette was a big deal. And then lastly, I think I really always look at landscape as the big character in my novels. In all my novels, whether it's Southern California in specific, whether it's Coachella. And this time I wanted people to think about the way that California worked during COVID in such a large sprawling state. People made connections that they might never have otherwise made. And I wanted people to think about the geography, like the way that canyons work and the way the freeways work and how everything was really deserted during COVID. And even the animals started to take over, didn't they? So Johnny Frias, who's the California Highway Patrol officer, plays a part in the book, and he has to rescue a runaway bull during COVID. That was a very fun scene to write. That was actually one of the hardest scenes. I spent the most time on that scene about the runaway bull. I have a friend who raises longhorn cattle in Rechi Canyon here in Southern California. And so it was really helpful. I had to go hang out at his place. He had a bull that used to be so tame, it would come inside his living room and watch the Super Bowl with him. And then one time the bull got excited and like gored the refrigerator. Oh. I remember that. But in any case, that I feel like that's a very California story too.
Yeah, right on. How about another reading?
I would love to read just a little section about that funeral that I mentioned. I thought listeners might like to know, I was really struggling with this book because I was worried about, you know, writing about something that seemed so sad. But one day I heard horses outside, and I went out to my front porch and a funeral was going by, and it looked exactly like this. The four horses wore pale blue ribbons in their manes. They stamped their feet gently in the parking lot at Our Lady of the Rosary. The cathedral's doors were open. Inside at the altar, Father Bill Devereaux stood alone. Only Norma Magana, whose husband Rudy Magana had died, sat in the front pew along with her four daughters while he said the Mass. And then the white casket was carried out by six young men, white suits, white bandanas, and pale blue shoes. They transported the casket through the back doors of a white carriage and slid it onto the satin bed. The horses tossed their heads, and the carriage driver said something to them in Spanish. And then all of the Impalas, 30 Impalas, all convertibles, followed the carriage down the road. Rudy, Ragaña, and Chencho Crescencio Sotelo had been lifetime members of the Imperials Car Club. They'd all gone to San Gregorio High School together, school colors blue and white. So the top sound 40 convertible Impala lowriders drove down Arrowhead Avenue near the church, waiting for Rudy Magana in the white carriage to lead them to the cemetery. And then the music began. Every car played the same song. Here comes the night owl. And it sounded like a real bird was singing in the day.
Wow. I'd like to remind everybody that I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by author Susan Strait, who is an award-winning author and just published a new novel, which I highly recommend, called Sacrament. Thank you, Susan.
Oh, what a pleasure it was to be here. I appreciate it.
In this next segment, Julie Lynam and Raise Up Radio explore the ways communities are navigating the complexities of raising children on the Central Coast and what needs to change to foster a greater sense of belonging.
We have two special guests, Dr. Carrie Langner, a professor and chair of the Department of Psychology and Child Development at Cal Poly, who currently teaches health psychology, cultural psychology, and psychology of conflict and justice, and Dr. Amanda Fry, who is assistant professor in the Department of Liberal Studies, teaches a variety of courses, including constitutional issues in the history of U.S. and California education and identity and equity in American schools. First, I'd like to thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I know this is starting out on a negative note, but right now there are kids who are experiencing a lot of pain. Of course, some kids have always been cruel. We know that. There have always been bullies, and there will always be bullies. But there appears to be a special kind of hate circulating, reserved for students on the margins, students of color, LGBTQ plus youth, students with disabilities, anyone who does not fit the traditional mold. I read stats recently from the American Academy of Pediatrics that about 1 in 4 bullied students reported hate-based harassment related to race, national origin, religion, disability, or sexual orientation. The most vulnerable populations being students with disabilities, who are 282% more likely to be bullied than their peers. LGBTQ plus youth also experience higher rates of victimization. So when it comes to bullying, what is your sense of what is happening in our schools? How pervasive are these attacks on BIPOC and other underrepresented students who don't fit that traditional mold? And are there any patterns or trends that we haven't seen before?
I kind of feel like the frustrating thing is that these are patterns and trends that we've seen before, like kids that are multiply marginalized have even deeper experiences of exclusion that have really difficult long-term implications for them. You know, I always think, you know, I tell my own students, right, human brains are wired to see difference. Like, we notice differences. It's part of how we navigate the world. It's not the noticing of difference that's the issue. It's the values that we place on the differences we notice. And so, like, there's, you know, really good, you know, research literature out there, plus, you know, any parent and most students, like, understand these evaluations of social status that can happen, like, right in the moment in a classroom interaction or on the playground or at school in some other way that really reflects the messages that kids have from the society around them about things like race and class and gender and sexuality and religion, language, you know, immigration status, right? They pick things up from the world we're in. And, you know, that understanding that there's a social value and that there's social power in exploiting the differences in value is a lesson kids pick up very early. So unless the classroom environment, the school environment, is one that is really designed from the beginning to sort of catch these moments and redirect those moments to give kids a way of understanding and seeing each other, you know, as meaningful contributors to the learning environment, the same kinds of labels, the same kinds of social stratification that's out there shows up in here, like over and over again. So for me, it's not new. It's just painful that we kind of need to accept and understand that with every generation, we need to be reteaching and reinforcing these kinds of understandings about how to live and work and learn together.
Carrie, what are you seeing?
I agree with everything that you've said, and I think that anything that we see happening at a broader cultural level, we shouldn't be too surprised when that is popping up in classrooms. And, you know, I think about, as a parent, you know, I've seen one of my children be bullied. I also saw in a case where my child had said something to another child. Luckily, I heard about it right away and was able to jump in and intervene with that. But I think if the adults are either not attending to that, minimizing it, or perhaps thinking that, oh, it's just what kids do, that sends a message to children. So I think about the children as they're exploring, testing, figuring out, right? They're taking in this information. And it's really our responsibility as parents, teachers, administrators, community members to be really active in shaping our responses to that. I've seen some data that it's up to 75% of bullying is identity-based, meaning could be about skin color, immigration status, sexual orientation, all these things we've been talking about. And I just wanted to point out that I think that type of bullying in particular can be even more damaging because it's attacking someone in terms of their self-concept. And I think all of us probably talking today and listening care very much about any individual child who's going through this. And then we can also think about it from a kind of broader public health perspective, right? If we don't intervene early, if we don't reduce this, we don't address it right away, we are increasing, right, possible mental health consequences down the road that are harder, right, to intervene with as you go further along.
I'm glad you bring that up because the next question really points to that, which is the mental health impacts that we've been seeing as a result of the harassment, intimidation, and exclusion of our youth due to bullying. So in your work, how have you been seeing that play out, and what lessons can we learn from what we've been seeing around mental health?
You know, I think we need more data, first of all. So it's challenging to draw the direct links between, let's say, the amount of bullying we're seeing right now with the surge that we've seen in mood disorders, for instance. So very high levels of anxiety in our youth right now. And there are a lot of things going on, right? We had the effects of the pandemic. We've got
social media.
Yeah, social media. We've got economic uncertainty. We could make up a really long list. But I think the fact that we know bullying has damaging effects on individuals, right? I feel like that's just an important piece of the puzzle that we need to be paying attention to. And, you know, at the same time, we have a shortage of mental health care providers or mental health care availability for youth. And that's a problem, you know, more broadly than our county, but certainly I'm sure we've all conversed with folks or dealt with that ourselves, you know, the difficulty of getting mental health care in a timely way. There's a moment where there's a lot of potential right now, but it's also frightening to me that youth are dealing with so many more stressors and we're seeing these gaps in our health care coverage all at the same time. One other lens we could take besides the health approach would be thinking about what's the economic impact for our schools. And so whether or not we agree with public schools getting funding on the basis of attendance, we know that absenteeism right now has a real educational outcome for the kids who are missing access to schooling. It has an economic outcome for the schools. And bullying is a major factor in children avoiding school.
Amanda, did you want to address any of the mental health impacts?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I would also kind of expand it to, you know, we hear the phrase all the time, hurt people hurt people. Mm. It applies to kids too. And that's why sometimes I'm like, you know, use the light touch when using labels around bullies and victims, because often the kid who has an increased need for asserting dominance and control over their social environment is a kid who has experienced some lack of support in some crucial ways in their own development. But I kind of flip it. Like, we know that there's scarcity in terms of resources and support mental health-wise, but we also know that if we start from the beginning, right, and you actually create nurturing learning environments where every kid can bring their whole self inside and not feel judged or belittled or excluded as a result of it, and there are things that educators can do to create those environments, you cut down on the ultimate need for intervening when things really go off the rails, you know, if you don't let them go quite off the rails in the first place. By being able to sort of teach and model the kind of positive behaviors and inclusive behaviors and skills that are out there that are well-researched, right? We can do a lot at the school level, at the classroom level, to help kids feel seen and valued and validated and understood. And that means those who might turn into the quote-unquote bully are going to have the support that they need from the beginning. Those who might one day be victimized, be on the receiving end, are going to have access to the support that they need. And I think also when educators can intervene in those positive ways, right? If something happens, exclusionary behavior happens in a classroom, and the teacher sees it and does nothing, sometimes that's worse than intervening, but maybe saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, right? We always have that right of repair, right? You can always go back and say, you know what? I tried to say something the other day. It didn't come out right. But the teacher that stands by, that sort of feels like they don't know the right thing to do or say, is inadvertently signaling that this behavior is tolerable and permissible. And so all the other kids are watching that interaction. Like, if somebody is excluding somebody else or treating somebody badly and there is no intervention, other kids get the message, number one, it's okay to treat people like this. But also, if I'm not careful, that can happen to me too. And so we set up these perpetuating cycles where it's just not a safe situation for anybody, which then has a negative effect on all kids' mental health, not just these maybe couple of focal participants we're worried about, right? Every kid who sees that possibility of social exclusion, of social harm, is affected, and their mental health is affected too.
I want to take a moment to remind listeners that you're listening to Raise Up Radio on KCBX. I'm Julie Lynam, speaking with Cal Poly professors Carrie Langner and Amanda Fry about how our underrepresented youth and their families are navigating an often hostile school climate. To our next question, so I've heard anecdotally that some teachers and administrators are so burned out and feel powerless to respond to this type of behavior. So what is being done to turn the tide in our schools and community? What's working and what's not working?
I can share an example of the project that I've worked on with Professor Lee, and we did that in collaboration with the San Luis Coastal School District. And what we did was a field experiment where we randomly assigned a set of elementary schools to an experimental condition, and then we had our control condition where they received the curriculum a little bit later, but we were able to kind of use their survey data to compare it to the intervention. The particular program that we were assessing is called Stand Up, Act Out, and it's a drama-based curriculum. We worked with second and third graders, and basically the goal of the program is to give children language, first of all, to talk about difference, kind of getting back to what Amanda was saying earlier, that it's okay and it's human to observe difference. And in fact, differences are important parts of who we are and we shouldn't ignore them, but how to do that right in an inclusive, respectful way. And they would hear these letters from fictional kids who were dealing with a bullying situation, and they would get to use drama games to act out as what we call peer upstanders. So there's this literature in social psychology about the bystander effect and, you know, where people feel like they're not sure if it's an emergency, they don't know if they're equipped to handle it. And we wanted to give kids tools to step in. And we know that peer intervention is particularly effective. We were focusing on peers because sometimes they're going to hear or observe something, right, that an adult maybe didn't see. At any rate, we did this big project. We surveyed the kids, and it reduced bullying in the intervention schools. It reduced their reports of bullying. And I think that's just one example, and, you know, self-promoting a little bit of our project here. But I think there's lots of ways that there can be collaboration, for instance, between Cal Poly and the school district, collaboration with community members, with parents. And ideally, this would be helpful to teachers, administrators, because the whole load is not on them alone.
I'd like to see that everywhere.
Yeah. I would love to as well. It's really fun, too. And the kids looked forward to it, right? Because there's Cal Poly students are coming in and they get to do games, right, for about an hour. And at the same time, what is ideally happening is that we're changing the social norms in that school, right? That we've now normalized that if you see someone being targeted, you stand up for them. Even if, you know, we have some examples we give to kids, you don't have to know the exact right thing to say. You can go stand next to someone who's being targeted. Just your physical presence can be important. And really trying to empower children that they actually are really important contributors to that social environment and that they have some control in making it a place that feels safe for them and their friends. And so it was really exciting to see that that was effective. That doesn't mean it solved bullying entirely, right? And when we looked at the data, it looked like about half of children who took the survey, half of them said that they had been targeted in some way. That's a little bit different from, you know, in the research literature when we talk about bullying, it's something that's like a chronic kind of repeated set of behaviors. When we found that half of kids were targeted, it could have been that it was just a one-time calling you a name, taking something from you, leaving you out of something. So we were trying to get it kind of the more micro level. But it does speak to, you know, our community is definitely dealing with this when we look at it at a data level, obviously also anecdotally, right? We know a lot of cases.
Well, Amanda, what do you think are some things that could turn the tide?
Well, building on that, I mean, I love the intervention and I love the creativity and the acting. And then what I always look for is sort of how can individual teachers carry over the lessons from the intervention so that it's part of the everyday life of the school, right? That starts to be harder, right? You know, whoa, teachers don't have a lot of time. There's lots of expectations for what happens during a school day. You know, so trying to think about building those models and really creating those opportunities for teachers and for school adults to continue to model empathy and teach kindness and find and highlight these great moments that support those principles that the kids learned about in the intervention, creating sort of family group models or classroom, like daily meetings or weekly meetings in the classroom, like creating those opportunities for kids to be seen and heard and valued. You know, there are things that teachers can do. In sociology, we talk about the difference between sort of a diffuse status characteristic, right? That's the social label that you get applied based on your race, your gender, your sexuality, right? It's something that sort of travels into the room before you even get there. But there are task-specific status characteristics. You know, so-and-so is really good at this particular math unit that we're doing, or so-and-so always asks such interesting questions when we are reading together, right? There's task-specific status, and there's context-specific status, right, in terms of what kind of a community member you are. So-and-so is always checking up on somebody, and the person that goes and asks if you're feeling better when you've been sick, highlighting those specific valuable characteristics that every kid has, and making that sort of part of the focus of how we get along together can go a long way to creating an environment where kids feel seen, heard, valued. And that makes it easier for them to be an upstander, right? It makes it easier for them to stick their neck out for somebody else. It makes them think twice before ostracizing a classmate if the social norm in the classroom, if the curriculum, the books on the bookshelves, the classroom activities are reflecting of these kinds of inclusive values, supportive, engaging, nurturing norms, it becomes a lot easier for students to replicate the learning from the intervention and for teachers to keep it going.
What if no one's coming? What if no one's coming to save you in an environment? And so what can youth do to protect themselves in a hostile situation and environment? And what can and should we all be doing to stop these harmful actions? I'm thinking about students who might be feeling alone and alienated in that moment. Do you all have any specific suggestions for how youth can protect themselves and what we can all do to help our youth
to respond?
I mean, I think of safety first. Mm-hmm. This is what I tell my own kids, right? Safety first. Assertiveness, which might be part of that safety, right? Mm-hmm. And an overall sense of empowerment, right? So practicing sort of scripted responses. If you have seen other people engage in these forms of exclusion or targeting others, and you know it's in the soup, you know it's sort of in the environment, what would I do or say if that happened to me? Thinking about your response in advance, sometimes this is a thing that parents can do with their kids. What would you ever do? What would you do if this happened, right? Using literature is always a wonderful way. Children's books are a wonderful way to start sparking those conversations with your kids.
Carrie, what do you have to say about how youth can protect themselves when they might be alone?
I just wanted to expand a little bit about the idea of practicing assertiveness. I think that's such an important tool that children can have. And I think as a parent, it can be challenging, you know, to explain and work through kind of the differences between being assertive versus being aggressive. But maybe thinking about it as this is a lifelong skill, this is really important for you to learn whether or not, you know, you're being targeted, even if it's after the fact, right? A child has been targeted. I think practicing, I love these ideas of using children's books, role-playing, practicing possible phrases. The thing that I wanted to add is to reach out and connect rather than isolate. So I think that one really damaging aspect of bullying is when children begin to feel isolated, that they're alone, right? They don't have anyone kind of with them or not feeling liked by others. And, you know, getting back to what you were mentioning about the stigma, I think there can be a real like sense of embarrassment, right? There's a lot of pressure to not talk to a teacher, not tell an adult. And so I think parents and teachers and administrators making it clear early on, not after there's a problem, but really all along, and this idea that school should be a safe place and it's a responsible thing to reach out to an adult when a situation is unsafe.
Well, I know our listeners will want to know what local resources exist if they want to have more information or find help. So do you both have some recommendations for our listeners?
Well, California has anti-bullying laws on the books, and they have requirements that every school district maintain a policy for actually anonymous reporting of a complaint or an incident with regard to lots of different factors. Your point earlier about schools are supposed to be safe places, and they can be unsafe in lots of different ways. So parents need to inform themselves. School departments are supposed to do this, but parents need to inform themselves about what those mechanisms are. Some schools do a really great job letting parents and kids know about the anonymous tip line or the phone line or the text line that they can use if there's an issue happening that they're uncomfortable with or something that they feel like they need support on. Just being able to have like reinforcement that that help is there, I think is important. And parents need to feel empowered to take advantage of those systems because they're there to protect your child and to make a safe environment for everybody. Sometimes it's sort of knowing that you're not the only person that has this on your mind can be super powerful. So yeah, we should keep talking.
Yeah. So with that, Carrie and Amanda, this was a much needed and important conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk on Raise Up Radio today. And I look forward to continuing the dialogue in the future. Until next time, take care and remember to lift every voice. You've been listening to Cal Poly professors Carrie Langner and Amanda Fry on Raise Up Radio. I'm Julie Lynam. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX in San Luis Obispo.
And that'll do it for this week's show. Our theme song is Soul Sync by Ketza. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX 90.1 FM in San Luis Obispo. Thanks to everyone who contributed to this week's program. Tom Wilmer, Brian Reynolds, and Julie Lynam. Today's show was mixed and produced by Emily Harris. Hank Hadley is our operations director. And I'm this week's host, executive producer, and KCBX news director, Monica Lopez. See you next time.